open the House Land Use Committee. Today's February 21st. No, excuse me, it's February 26th. The agenda was posted. We're off to a rough start. The agenda was posted February 21st. And first order of business is we've got two House bills that we heard a few weeks ago anyway, February 12th. And my request after looking at them is, although I know we have members interested in the financial aspects of these and lending things, these really don't have any land use implications, it turns out, in the bills. So my ask is that we send them to their next committee. There's more after that, I believe, but the next committee is the Transportation and Economic Development Committee, with no recommendation because they don't have any land use implications in this particular case.
Mr. Chair, I move that with that House Bill 2284, I move House Bill 2284 without recommendation to the Transportation and Economic Development Committee by prior reference.
Did you open a work session?
Let me open a work session.
Again, maybe you might want to do
House Bill 2284 and take your motion again.
One more time with feeling. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2284 without recommendation to the Transportation and Economic Development Committee by prior reference.
Thank you. Vice Chair Frederick moves House Bill 2284 without recommendation to the Transportation and Economic Development Committee by prior reference. Any discussion? Vice Chair Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We may not have land use issues behind these bills today, but I believe there are land use issues that are causing these bills to come forward. So my request for Representative Reed would be that we would have more time for public hearing and get behind some of the issues that are driving us to have public policy to help us get through a complicated public policy in the private sector.
Thank you. I also think the Senate is hearing a whole bunch of these kind of industrial lands bills right now. I don't know which ones will get over here, but there's a Senator Lee Byer day in front of the Senate Land Use Committee over this same stuff. So for those of you who are interested in following it more closely, you might even check in on how those are going. I was going to go listen to it, actually, just to get a preview of what those bills are that come out of the interim Senate Transportation and Economic Development Committee. Any further discussion on the motion? Okay, seeing none, with the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Unger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye. Motion passes and the bill sent on to TED Committee.
TED Committee.
You did TED without recommendation.
Without recommendation, yeah. And I'll open a work session on House Bill 2285.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2285 without recommendation to the Transportation and Economic Development Committee by prior reference.
Vice Chair Frederick moves House Bill 2285 without recommendation to the Transportation and Economic Development Committee by prior reference. Any discussion? Vice Chair Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to say the same thing over again. The same bill is the fact that there are land use issues that are behind the reasons why we're even having to discuss this concept. So I hope that Chair Reed will give us plenty of time to discuss the obstacles for the private sector being able to have more industrial sites ready to go.
Any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, with the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Patrick.
Aye.
Representative Lundstedt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Chair Clement.
Aye. Motion passes and the bill is sent to the TED Committee without recommendation. Okay. I'm going to open our public hearings on both House Bill 2201 and 2202, so you can comment on both of them while you're up and not have to come back and re-sign up later and just weigh in pro or con or neutral or what other iterations of opinion you have on both bills at the same time. So I'm going to open the public hearings on House Bill 2201 and 2202. get my sign-up sheet. I know we have a few people who have some urgent situations. And that's Katie Kula and Steve Wilding. I think it was Steve, Mr. Wilding, and or Wildish. Wildish, sorry. Sorry about that. Without looking at your sign-up sheet, I know you have somewhere to be. And, well, why don't the two of you come up, and we'll just, we'll get through you two. Somebody's pregnant, I think. Not you, Mr. Wildish.
And, actually, he just walked outside, so they went to retrieve him. Steve Wilder just walked outside.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Excuse me, we're part of an organization, and we're in the state.
Oh, okay. Okay. Why don't you two come up then, or you three or four, and then and then we'll get Mr.
Wildish.
It's okay. You bet.
I think this will benefit all of us. I'll go first. Thank you for having me and for being okay with me bringing my children. It was the only way this was going to happen. I'm here to support...
We just need you to state your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. So thank you for reminding me. My name is Katie Kula. Do I need to say my address? No. No, not for this.
No.
That's okay. A different setting.
Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to come against the odds to support anything that helps preserve Class 1 and 2 farmland here in the state of Oregon. I wanted to just come and be a face of people who are affected by aggregate mining and also who are involved in farming. I know that I'm just one of thousands who can't, for whatever reason, come to these sorts of hearings because they're committed to their farms or because they live quite a distance away. I'm fortunate to live just a few miles away from Salem. My husband and I farm on Grand Island, which is an agricultural island in Yamhill County, just north of here. We have a 100-acre organic farm, and our island is full of thriving, diverse farms. You have larger grass seed farms, smaller farms like ours, even smaller farms doing direct marketing. It's quite an agricultural scene. On any given day in the summer, there's all sorts of products coming and going. People are making their living off of it. They're contributing to the local economy. The challenge for us is that this is also a place that's attractive to gravel quarries. We already have two quite large, several hundred acre quarries that have been approved on the island, making up about 15% of the farmland on the island at this point. For us, my husband and I are young. We're in our early 30s. We're looking to the future, possible expansion, just viability of being in the place. We worry about what the long-term impacts of this are going to be for us, for our children. I know that already many of the farmers are worrying about competition for existing farmland, especially these prime soils with water. So again, I just wanted to be here so you could see me, and we have the two kids, and thank you for all the work that you do here in the Capitol.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Chris Bledsoe, and I also reside on Grand Island, and I am Katie's mother and Rusty and Dottie's grandmother. And I have the farm right next door to their farm, and I raise animals, heritage animals, and I supply a lot of the stock for their farm, as well as feed families and friends with rare breeds of turkeys and hogs and sheep and whatever. But my concern, of course, we are immediately affected, as Katie explained, and we are part of a broader group which is called Protect Grand Island Farms, and Katie's the president of that board. And we have been fighting for over 2 years. We have been fighting the approval of a Baker Rock quarry at the south end of our island. And there are many, many reasons which are not the reason we're here today, but there are many reasons why we think that would be inappropriately placed. But I think that if you look at the broader, at the state, there in almost every instance is a reason why a quarry that takes farmland away from the community is an inappropriate place for that quarry. There are other places for quarries. Yes, we do need rock, but we also need farmland. And one of my biggest concerns when I was thinking about this, what I would say to you, because I did already send a note to each of you on our board's behalf, but we have an abundance of water on our island, as does every other farm along the river. And we have Class 1 and Class 2 soils. If you allow the continued destruction of Class 1 and 2 soil along the river, you are taking not only some of the best farmland out of production, but some of the only farmland that has adequate water to continue to farm for the unforeseeable future. It's a double-edged sword because we also have flooding, but that we also get great soil and we have great wells and we have access to the river in some cases. And so to transfer the quarries to land that is not so fertile and does not have water just makes good long-term sense. And my concern is about the future farmers of America, not just these farmers, but the farmers 100 years from now and 200 years from now. I think we tend to think very, very short term when we're talking about aggregate and extraction from the land, because that's the nature of our modern society. But we must think about what will we regret if we take this land today. And I thank you for your time. And if you have any questions of us, we're available for that.
Any questions for these two witnesses, citizens? These four. Representative
one
Davis.
Question, yes.
Thank you, Chair. As a father of 1-year-old, thanks for bringing the kids in. I'm serious. I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you for putting up with us. My
no, I know the feeling.
I have a child care, so we had to kind of all come together. But thank you very much. And you know where to find us if you have more questions about Protect Grand Island Farms or our particular situation, or if you'd like to give us more input.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Thank you. Thank you for Mrs. Bledsoe for coming and testifying. You said that there is a authorization for a mine now on Grand Island.
The county has approved it, but we are in fact we have an appeal with LUBA right now to stop that. This will be our third time to LUBA. And with this particular quarry, we do have the other quarry which has been approved, which is about 300 acres, I believe, but has not begun. And, you know, the impacts on our particular island, as I said, I don't think is necessary. I mean, if you want to know more about that, I'd be happy to let you know. But
follow up, if I may, who owns the land now where the permit is being
Baker Rock requested? Owns the land, and that's a really interesting question, because one of the things that I think is really important to recognize is that as long as we have Class 1 and Class 2 soil available for quarries, it drives the price up so that farmers cannot afford to buy the land themselves, particularly small farmers. So it was sold to Baker Rock by a farmer under duress, but what we really need to look at is if I'm a farmer under duress and I'm going to get $1,000 an acre here and I'm going to get $3,000 here because Baker Rock or another quarry can make $10,000 an acre, economics makes it so that this land is sold to the highest bidder. That's just common sense. But what I would like to see is farmland be priced as farmland and not as extractive land, because it really changes the competitiveness of the market.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet.
Any other questions?
Oh, you're free to go.
We will leave.
I like your hat.
Okay, so why don't we have Steve Wildish and Steve Pfeiffer come up, and then after that I'll go to 3 and 3. We'll just do 2 and 2. Did we not find Steve?
Chair Clem, Mr. Wildish apparently is in a meeting with someone to set it aside, so you may want to put somebody behind me.
Okay, how about Paul Hibernick?
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, members of the committee. I'm Steve Pfeiffer. My address is 1120 Northwest Cooch, Portland, Oregon, 97204. I'm a land use lawyer with the firm of Perkins Coie.
I see Stoll Reeves on here, though, that threw me off.
That wasn't my handwriting.
Yeah, okay.
That's
a former life.
Former life.
All right, sorry about that.
So I'm a land use lawyer in practice and have for 30-plus years in Oregon, the best state in the country, frankly, to practice land use law. And in addition, I was on the Land Conservation and Development Commission from 1994 probably to 2000 and chaired it for the last three of those years. But the reason I bring that up today is the nature of 2202 is obviously, as you just heard and well know, to address the issue, which was not new to the commission at the time and it's still out there today, of the inherent tussle between aggregate and farming. I grew up in a farm in Yamhill County. I know that side of the equation very well. And when I was on the commission, it was apparent to those of us in the practice and as well as the commissioners that farming, agricultural activities and land use is an inherent conflict. And one of the reasons for that is both of those uses, as well as others, are location specific. Where you find the aggregate, and there are people I suspect who will follow me, will explain some of that geomorphology about why the aggregate lies in some of the areas where our very best farmland also happens to lie, again, is simply a fact which gives rise to a conflict which has been with us from the duration of this program from the 70s. Prior to 1976, or actually prior to about 1995 probably, we had a system in place to permit aggregate operations on farming, and as you know, in EFU zones by statute and therefore by local plans and ordinances, agricultural activities are an allowed as of right use. It's a broad definition, wide range of activities, right to farm bills in place. The agricultural conflict really doesn't exist except to the extent that someone tries to replace that soil or that land at that location. On the other hand, aggregate has always been the subject of discretionary approval process at the counties primarily, and prior to about 1995, for reasons I'll mention, it was an increasingly uncertain process to all parties, to the adjacent farmers, to the aggregate operator, to those of us who were advocates for either of those groups, and frankly, to the counties themselves. And I would submit that by the time we got done after about 15 years of case law, the appellate courts were running the system as to how to reconcile the conflicts between farm use and aggregate in this state. Then up came a very clear persuasion from our governor at the time, Governor Kitzhaber, that this is a conflict that needed to be addressed to the extent possible. I had just come on the commission, and I volunteered to chair a subcommittee to address that as well as other issues under the rubric of Statewide Planning Goal 5, which is our resource-specific goal. And our charge was from the state is based on an acknowledgement that this is a matter of statewide interest. Just as agriculture was a matter of statewide interest, so is the idea was, so is aggregate production. It's a foundation building block. It's obvious to all of us that it's part of our daily lives, increasingly so. We were told to address this conflict as best we could. My personal view was to get it out of the hands of the appellate courts. And frankly, I took that view while I was on the commission in other ways as well, because I don't believe the appellate courts are the appropriate place to make land use policy in the state. I think it starts here with you, and I think it filters down to the foot soldiers of the field in the cities and counties, and there needed to be an LCDC set of regulations in the middle that gave some guidance and certainty to all parties. We were endorsed in that approach by the governor at the time, and the question before us was not whether aggregate mining should be allowed, but how would it be allowed, under what circumstances, and how do we reconcile that conflict, particularly with significant Class 1 and 2 lands. That gave rise to a two-year subcommittee, which I chaired, which we established with stakeholders of every persuasion, from environmental advocacy groups to the Farm Bureau to a wide range of participants. Now, there are 12 resources under Goal 12, as you all know. Of those 2 years, I would submit, in retrospect, probably 60% of that debate had to do with the aggregate farmland conflict. And out of that process came an administrative rule that we adopted in 1996 in the fall, which is one of the many administrative rules implementing the goals. And Division 23, in addressing the other 11 Goal 5 resources, has a very specific provision addressing aggregate mining, and the nature and how a county may authorize
mining, not just on agricultural land, on forest land as well, but primarily on agricultural. It gave rise to a compromise of sorts with the Farm Bureau, the aggregate industry, and the others of who are part of that discussion, and it's embodied in the rule. And there are others who will speak more specifically to how we addressed it. But simply put, Class 1 and 2 farmland is the best of the best, and we accepted that. Secondly, there was compelling testimony from the agricultural industry that that land could arguably and should arguably be subject to a higher standard for review in terms of make sure you've got a significant aggregate resource before you're allowed to go forward and go through the review process on that. And significance can be measured in volume, it can be measured in depth of the resource, and all, in fact, under the rule, it is measured that way. So the point is that that rule gave rise to, or rather that discussion gave rise to a compromise between the industry and the industries and their various advocates, which set in motion a higher bar for aggregate mining proposals on land of Class 1 and 2 soils, at least as to significance. The second thing we were very careful to do is acknowledge as one of the six types of conflicts that an aggregate operator would have to address, noise, dust, and other discharges, farm practices as something that could be adversely affected by a mining activity or a proposed mine were one of the key provisions that must be addressed. The burden of proof's on the applicant. They have to show how, and to that extent, we actually codified ORS 197-296, which is the long-standing criterion applicable throughout the state that says if you have a use in EFU land that will or may increase the cost of agricultural activities or threaten the continued practice of agriculture, you have to minimize or somehow resolve that conflict. The point I'll leave you with is that that process gave rise to a set of regulations which, perhaps depending on your perspective, have served us well. I've participated in a number of aggregate sightings since then. I've won some and I've lost some. And there are many others who will say on both sides of the equation that they've won some and they've lost some. Is it perfect? Probably not. Is it in place? Yes, absolutely. And was it the result of a significant amount of thoughtful participation by many people of many persuasions in the course of generating that rule? Over a two-year period of time, I think the answer is unequivocally yes. The last point I'll leave you with is 2202 does present something that's to a permitting lawyer like me, to some extent strikes fear in my heart, and that's the process by which, under, as I understand the bill today, you would be able to cite an aggregate operation, provided you could demonstrate the extraordinary significance of that resource at that location required under the rule, and that you show that there's no alternative location in a hierarchy of lands, other lands, exception lands, committed exception lands, or even in urban growth boundaries. And I'll leave you with this thought. However you proceed with this, if for some reason you decide that the rule that we have in place now, that Division 23 Run 80 rule that we have after that 96 effort, isn't adequate, the alternatives approach in that law really does take us away from not whether and under what circumstances could a mining activity in that location be permitted, but takes you very quickly into whether it could ever be permitted at all. And I would submit, based on my experience with the exceptions process and the appellate process, that would be an exceedingly difficult task to permit a mine in that sense. You would have to be able essentially to show that an applicant has the burden, and it says the use, not the project, but the use. The aggregate mining as a use, however small, however large, would have to be shown to not be feasible in any other locations, literally in the valley. That is a very high bar, and if not an insurmountable bar. And I find that very difficult, and frankly, if I had my druthers, I'd go to the rule and see a few more of these play out to make sure that we can't continue to make fine-tuning and make it work. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Let's have this gentleman speak first, and then we'll do questions for both of you at the same time, if that's okay. Unless Steve is here yet. But
Paul Rivernick, my address is 805 Southwest Broadway, Portland, Oregon, 97205. I'm also a lawyer. I'm with Fleming Black Helter Line, and I do a lot of work with the aggregate industry, and I cite aggregate. I handed out to the committee a Farm Bureau newsletter from Don Schellenberg from 1996, and I handed it out, and I'm going to actually read from it the highlighted reasons, because it really summarizes what was going on in 1996, the process that Steve just talked about. It says, today's Goal 5 rules for permitting aggregate mine are very vague. That's pre-96. There are no special provisions for protecting agricultural land from mining. No special provisions. And so what we did in 96, and I was part of that process, is we made provisions that protected the farmland from mining under certain rules. You skip down. It says, initially, the Farm Bureau proposed mining not be allowed on prime farmland. That's where we're back today. And he goes on to say that neither LCDC nor the governor, that was Governor Kitzhaber, wanted a provision that simply bans aggregate mining in the Willamette Valley. And my opinion about this is that that's what 2202 actually does. Agriculture wanted a ban. That conflict had to be resolved. The reality was that if Farm Bureau and the agri community did not come together, LCDC and the governor were going to do it, and neither one of us would like it. Okay? Then Mr. Schellenberger goes on in this piece that's from 1996, sent out in the Farm Bureau. He said points 1 through 9 are going to minimize loss of prime farmland from aggregate mining, and we have none of them in a current rule. That's the process that Steve Pfeiffer described for you as the Goal 5 rule, 660-23-180, that was put into place. Now, we've heard some talk that there might be some testimony on the page 2 of this that number 6 and number 10 somehow didn't get into the rule, that counties cannot regulate farming practice to mitigate conflicts with mining. Number 10 does the same thing. That's just not true. 660.23 says as follows. This is the existing Goal 5 rule. Local governments are not required to regard agricultural practices as conflicting uses. In other words, the problem is not the farm. The problem is the gravel. Okay. The 180 section of 662.23 says conflict. It defines a conflicting use as one that would be adversely affected by mining or processing activities. Again, gravel is the conflicting use under this rule that came up in 1996, not farms. Okay. The rule goes on to say, and specifically list, a conflict. It said the governments must examine whether approved land uses within the impact area will be adversely affected by the proposed mining operation. So the rule instructs the local government to see if farms are adversely affected. That's the existing rule that we have now. And then it goes on to further say that one of the defined conflicts that the county or city or local jurisdiction must address, they must address conflict with agricultural practices. So the idea that somehow this rule that was put in place in 1996 didn't get all, we missed some of the Farm Bureau's agenda, is simply not true. And the final point was a point that Mr. Pfeiffer brought up, and that's that we specifically reincorporated 215-296 back into the Goal 5 rule, which kicks us out of the Goal 5 rule, kicks us right back into statute like any other thing, and we have to demonstrate, the gravel operator has to demonstrate that we will not have any significant adverse effect on farmland in the surrounding area, and we will not have any significant cost change on any farmland in the surrounding area. That is part of the rule that you would completely overturn with this bill. We've also heard that there's some talk that the farmers always lose in this process. And I'm here to tell you, Mr. Pfeiffer said he's won some and lost some. I've won some and lost a lot of them. And I was sitting down and I thought of 9 off the top of my head in 9 separate jurisdictions where wonderful gravel, wonderful close proximity to routes, close proximity to urban areas where the gravel would be used, and the farmland prevailed under the process that we have. Mullala River Reserve in Clackamas County, Copeland in Josephine County, Smith in Multnomah County, Delta in Lane County, Beaver State in Douglas County, Myers in Columbia County, Aylett in Umatilla County, there was another one in Morrill County, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of that one, they lost. Westside Rock in Clackamas County spent $1 million in the permitting process and lost. The farm is still there. Eugene Sand and Gravel spent more than $1.2 million in Eugene Lane County in a permitting process under this rule and lost. The farm is still there. In Columbia County, Glacier took approximately 20 years to ultimately cite something under this rule and its predecessors. My personal favorite is the Friel case down in Jackson County, 12 years through the process, 2 times up to the Court of Appeals, 2 times up to LUBA, And ultimately, that one was approved. So to say that this process somehow favors the gravel industry and doesn't favor the farm industry, or that it's not some sort of an even deal that was negotiated by people who knew what they were doing and had all the stakeholders at the table, is simply not true. Let me talk about the specifics of 2202, and it sets up, intentionally so, it sets up an exceptions process. It doesn't say that. It says alternatives, but the net effect and how the Court of Appeals would actually determine this is an exception process. And I can count on one hand the number of reasons exceptions that have been approved in the state of Oregon, and that number is zero, to my knowledge. I am unaware of any exceptions. Bob Rindy's in the room. You can ask him if he knows of any reasons exceptions that were done. You lose them at the Court of Appeals because you cannot find alternatives. And in this particular case, let me tell you how this worked before 1996. Before we had the Goal 5 rule, what would happen, we had an alternatives test in there. And you'd go to a public hearing, and an applicant would come in, and they would say there's six potential gravel sites in the area. And an opponent would come in and would say, oops, you forgot the one down on Washington Road. And so the proponent would go down to Washington Road, perhaps couldn't get access to see the geology, perhaps because it's private property, and would have to come back in and say that's not an alternative. If they were able to establish that, they would come back in the process, and opponents would come back in and say, oh, there's one down on Jackson Road that you need to look at. And on one case, I went through six different iterations of that where one by one an alternative was played out in the process. And that didn't make fair use of the local county's time, and it didn't give anybody a fair shake through the process. There is a concern about farmland, and a justifiable concern about farmland. It's important to us as citizens of Oregon. But I want to give you one unusual statistic that you may not be aware of. This came out of the interagency study. This was all studied again in 2005, and there were several studies that came up. Harvested acreage in the state of Oregon, this harvested acreage, that's farmers working to harvest crops on acreage in the state of Oregon in 1977, was about 920,000 acres. In 2003, which is the last figures that we have, and that was the last figures that are in the study, what was the amount of harvested acres? Did it go down? Did it go up? It was the same, about 920,000 acres. We are an infinitesimal small portion of this. We're less than 0.1% of Class 1 and Class 2 farmland, and this bill would prohibit anyone going forward. There'll be other people that talk about jobs. I would just like to give you one other statistic that I think is significant, and it came out of all these intergovernmental studies in 2005. Taking Marion County, which is where some of us have farms, 1994 to 2003, that 10-year period, the county lost 4,000 acres to churches, accessory dwellings on farmland, commercial uses, and schools. It lost 4,000 acres of high-value farmland. During that same period of time in Marion County, 400 acres of gravel were permitted. This is not the problem. 2202 does not address the problem.
Question for these gentlemen. Representative Holby.
Thank you both for coming and testifying, giving us some historical background for this issue. I think it's important for this committee to hear that. But I wanted to check on one statistic I thought I heard. I wasn't really sure, but I'm you know, a few pieces of data going by, but I'm curious of the amount of Class 1 and Class 2 farmland in the Willamette Valley. What percentage of that does do mining operations take up? Did you say 0.1%?
0.1%. It's 0.119. Rich, is that right?
Zero.
I'll be heading this up.
Okay. Yeah. 0.119. So it's less than 0.1%.
Thanks. I just wanted to make sure I heard that right.
Any other questions for this gentleman? Representative Davis.
Thanks for your testimony. And maybe somebody else testifying later, but do we know the number that have been successfully cited in the Willamette Valley in the last 10, 15 years, and the average application process and fees? And I say that as an attorney, so I understand.
Okay, well, I can tell you from my own perspective. I have successfully cited 1, 2 in Marion County, One in Yamhill County, and application fees for the first one, just the fees that they would, the permit applicant would have gone forward, the drilling fees, the geologists, the lawyers, everything else, that one was about $380,000. The one in Yamhill County, that it took, and that one took 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
The one in Yamhill County was about 2.5 years, and that took about $220,000. And the most recent one in Marion County, it took about a year. It's adjacent to Mr. Chapin's property, and that was the total cost of that was about $170,000.
Okay.
I can think of one in Yamhill County that was not appealed. Total fees, because it came to me yesterday, consultants and everything was about $120,000. Legal was probably $30,000. I can think of another one in Marion County that was on class one, and you know. Again, the package there was probably, it's a, not a cheap exercise. It's probably, I would have guessed that one is $600,000-$700,000 because we've got a lot of consultants piled in there. And another $150,000 because that went up to the Court of Appeals on fees. And then, for better or for worse, I was leading the charge on the Eugene Sand denial, which probably, as Paul points out, holds the record for the most expensive permit application, let alone denial, coming in at over a mil. Mm-hmm. And that was down in Eugene. And that was, that's the one that, just as an aside, that one had every piece of agricultural conflict issue you could imagine, from causing respiratory ailments to the racehorses a farm or so away, to dust on the organic peaches immediately across the fence. It was a large project. It was a 600-acre project, riverine next to the river. I remember the farm stand conflicts of the aggregate trucks competing with the people who were showing up on the farm stand on weekends. That was one that, again, and the only reason I point that out is the reason that one, the way it was cited in a dense area, it was a very thorough analysis. It probably took 9 to 12 months of multiple hearings with a lot of activity of all from people of every persuasion, and it presented every conceivable level of analysis in terms of that conflict, again, between ag and aggregate.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Let's get Bruce Chapin and Sam Sweeney. Two and two. And how about Marge Easley? We'll switch to three and three now. And because I gave that panel about longer than I probably should on average, I know we've got at least two people here who could easily go over 5 minutes, so I'll let you two go to match that. After that, we'll try and keep everybody to about 5 minutes if we can. Okay, so Bruce, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Bruce Chapin. Live at 9965 Wheatland Road, North Salem, down the Mission Bottom area, just north of Kaiser. I serve as the chairman of the Oregon Farm Bureau Aggregate Committee, and 2004 through 2007, I served on the governor's consensus process between aggregate and agriculture, trying to resolve the issue there.
Bruce, pull the mic over so we can hear in the back.
And I've been told I'm not being heard. Is that better?
That's better, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Okay, the problem that needs to be addressed in Willamette is, and I'm going to talk, I'm going to talk on 2202 first, if you don't mind. And the problem that needs to be addressed in the Willamette Valley, the aggregate strip mining has taken about 200 to 400 acres of farmland a year. For visual comparison, that's about 90 city blocks that's being lost. Recent DAGAMI data indicates that there's over 10,000 acres being mined in the Willamette Valley at this time. On the second page, you've got a Google Earth map that I have there, and outlined in yellow is the area known as Mission Bottom, which is just north and west of Kaiser. In fact, if you look at the bottom left corner of the picture, you can see the north end of Kaiser there showing up. The red represents the mined areas, the areas being mined, and the areas that are going to be mined. And putting this map together, I began to realize this is a little bit of an invisible problem because about a third of the red areas, there's no sign of mining going on them today, but they are destined to be mined. The red represents about 1,000 acres in there. And up in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a field that's outlined in white. That's about a 90-acre field. It's not permitted to be mined at this time. There's been no applications on that yet. However, it has been, a year ago, test holes were put across that field. These are equivalent to putting wells down in order to test the soil or test for rock down there, which means somebody is very significant, very serious about getting ready to mine it. The area in blue there is the Willamette Mission Park, which represents another 1,800 acres. So as you can see that the privately owned farmland is quickly disappearing in Mission Bottom. And no, Mr. Hibernick is correct. It's not just the agri-industry that we're having a problem with. We are losing farmland. It comes from multiple issues, but the agri-industry are making a major contribution. And as a third-generation farmer in the area, farming with two of my kids, this loss of farmland is very important to me. In 2010, Marion County produced over 3 million tons of aggregate. And much of Marion County's aggregate production is going into the Portland market. It's going there by truck, and it's going there by train. You turn to the next page, you see a picture of a 18-car unit train that makes multiple trips per day hauling aggregate from Mission Bottom to the Portland area. This demonstrates that trains are tools that can transport aggregate economically for long distances. And like all tools, they can be used for good or they can be used for bad. In this case, this train is accelerating the destruction of our best farmland. But it also demonstrates that trains can be used to move aggregate long distances from sites that are not underneath good farmland into our markets and help save our farmland. There is virtually an unlimited supply of hard rock quarry located away from our best farm soils. Today, about 50% of the Willamette Valley aggregate comes from hard rock quarries. And I know of no example where one of these hard rock quarries is destroying good farmland or our best farmland. So many opportunities exist to expand our production of hard rock quarries. You have a picture there of a hard rock quarry that's located west of Hillsboro. We were told that they've excavated down over 500 feet. Stop and think about this for a minute. A quarry that excavates 500 feet deep can get one heck of a lot of rock, without destroying much surface area. Compare that to the shallow mining that's being done in the sand and gravel operations, which is often less than 40 feet deep. They have to consume a lot of ground in order to get a significant volume. Also, we got the option, there's very large deposits of round rock along the Columbia River deposited by the ancient Missoula floods, and those are under very poor soils. Some of these round rock deposits, along with hard rock quarry deposits, are being economically transported to Portland by barge. Rock is barged to Portland from Dallasport, Wishram, Boardman, St. Helens, and British Columbia. So once again, we can move rock long distances. While the aggregate industry has many alternatives to using good farm soils, the agriculture industry does not have reasonable alternatives to farming good soils. And this can be seen on the picture on the last page there. What you see in that picture is a filbert orchard. On the right-hand side, the trees are about 5 feet tall. On the left side, the trees are about 25 feet tall. The trees on the right are non-productive. The trees on the left are very productive and very profitable. They're the same age trees. They've had the same care, same variety. The difference is soil type. We need good soils. While much is going to be said today, I think, about the potential alternatives of the aggregate industry has to mine elsewhere, recognize that House Bill 2202 is not dependent on there being reasonable alternatives. The bill simply directs that alternatives be looked for. Looking for reasonable alternatives is a very necessary step in a rational problem-solving process. And currently, the permitting process does not have the authority to look for alternatives. So I urge you to please support this so as to give the local governments the authority they need to appropriately balance the two industries' interests. This is a very modest approach to a problem that was created by a state land use system that singled out the Willamette Valley. It is only in the Willamette Valley that the aggregate industry that can mine are Class 1 and 2 soils. The rest of the state is protected. This was in the 1996 rewrite. Every place else in the state of Oregon, they do not allow them to mine sites or don't allow them to permit sites if they're going to be mining on over 35% Class 1 and 2 soils, primary unique. There was statements made about if this alternative analysis was put in, it would create tremendous legal problems, and because of its, you know, what is a good alternative or not. I just point out that currently what we have is, for the basis of our legal foundation or our land use foundation, is Oregon's ORS 215-296, and what that says that you can only come into an EFU zone and site other activities if they will not significantly adversely affect the surrounding farming operations. That is, put politely, provides the planners with a lot of flexibility as to what is significant and what is an adverse problem. I heard it stated today that we have no conflicts with agriculture, between the agriculture industry and the aggregate industry. If that's true, I'm not sure why we're here. Because, at least from my perspective, I think we have a lot of conflicts. It was also stated that the 1996 change is working very well at protecting our farmland. Let me share with you a little bit how this process has worked from what I have seen.
Two more minutes, Bruce.
Two more minutes? Okay, I'll hold it right down. You've got what the concept of 96 was written into here, that the miners would only be allowed to mine our best farmland if they could mine deep, get a lot of gravel for the amount of farmland they destroyed. And this thickness standard was set and varies from county to county through the valley. In Marion County, we have a depth standard of 60 feet. In 2002, Windsor Island Rock wanted to mine the north end of Windsor Island. Because of their proximity to the river, it was known in the permitting process that they would only be allowed to go down 26 feet. So the question is, does that qualify or doesn't it? If you look at the wording in the Goal 5 rule, it appears that it doesn't matter how deep they can mine. It only matters that the rock exists. And that's how the county interpreted it, and the site was permitted. So they have access to the best farmland and only are going to dig or only are digging half the depth of what is required. Would normally be thought of as being required. So then in 2012, we go down to Grand Island, and they have a similar question, or they have a question on what this standard means. In that case, Yamhill County has a depth standard of 25 feet, and they have a gravel layer that's 22 feet deep, separated by 9 feet of clay down to a next gravel layer. So the question is, is that going to be allowable under the law, under the rule, or not? And the answer that came back was, yes, that's allowable because they're going to planning on mining both of them. So there it was interpreted that it's not the depth of the individual layer that matters, it's the depth that they're going to mine and how much rock they're going to mine. So we've seen a inconsistent interpretation of what's there, and it's done in a way that has not resulted in protection of farmland in either case there. And with that, I'll open myself up for questions. I could also give testimony on 2201 if you'd like.
I would do everything together. That's in the beginning. That's what I mentioned. Everybody okay. does everything together. Sam, you're up.
Okay.
You can read it then.
Thank you.
Chairman Clem and members of the committee, my name is Sam Sweeney. I live at 1070 Ferry Street in Dayton, Oregon. I'm a part of a three-generational farm family that has farmed in Amhill County for about 90 years. And we farm a lot of the different soils that we've talked about, and we have different opinions on all of them. We heard earlier from two attorneys that said, you know, there's a lot of protection under the present ordinances. Apparently that doesn't apply in Amhill County because I don't think we've, on the farm end, I don't think we've had one success at all. Let me tell you what happened. In Amhill County, there were some conversions that took place starting in the mid-1980s, and we were kind of unaware of them. They were close by, but we didn't hear too much about them. And then in 2004, there was an application for a conversion change that would allow mining. We got one of the best attorneys in the state, operated under all the laws that the two attorneys talked about, and we lost. The next year, on Grand Island, there was another application, and we fought that one, and we lost. In 2010, there was another application that was filed, and we had a good attorney. He operated under the same laws that the two attorneys described that would protect farmland, and we lost. Altogether, since 2005, we've lost 800 acres of some of the finest land in the state of Oregon. And I say that because I've farmed these soils. I know how valuable, how productive they are, and it's just really a loss. Now, since the mid-80s, altogether we've lost about 1,300 acres that have been committed to agriculture. Amhill County doesn't have a lot of these soils. There's two significant areas. One is down in Lambert Bend, Dorsey Bottoms. There's about 1,500 acres. 500 of that has been committed or has been mined and has been, is committed to mining. So there's about 1,000 acres left. You go up to Grand Island, it's a 4,000-acre island, and about 600 acres of that has been committed. I mean, we're fighting one. I don't think we're going to win it. I mean, we've taken all these cases all the way up to Luba, Oregon Court of Appeals, never won. So the two attorneys saying we're protected under that, we sure weren't protected in Amhill County. It's just those two 96s that they talked about, they're too widely open for interpretation. It's subjective, and we're just not protected enough. So the end result is that down on Grand Island, where 16% of that is committed to mining. Now, it's not only the loss of the soil and the production that comes out of it, but also there's 25 farm families down there that rely on that area for meeting their livelihood. And so when that island is gone, and, 16%, where are they going to go after that? The miners, each one's got about a 30-year life, so when are they going to go? They're going to probably buy the adjoining piece. A land use planner told me, says, within 100 years, all that bottom land is really going to be non-existent for farming because most of it's going to be committed for agriculture or for mining. So where do we go? Where do we go? I mean, we've lost 4,000, maybe 5,000 acres. We don't have any alternatives. They don't make agricultural land anymore. In contrast, the aggregate industry, the hills are full of surrounding rock. There's plenty of places they can go. They have lots of options. And I just think that we really need to look in that direction because when this good bottom land, and believe me, I farm these lands. I know how valuable, how productive, how unique they are. There's a certain microclimate right close to the river that's unique. You won't find it anywhere else. And that's why CSE Agriculture has found the island. They found it so productive, and it's quite attractive to them. So, I strongly urge you to take a look at this bill because, in the future, I think all of us are going to regret approving these conversions allowing mining, because once they're gone, you're never going to get them back. And I'll show you what you're going to get. Right on the back page of my testimony is a picture. I want you to look at it. That's what it's going to end up, all these valley soils with all these pits. You can never do anything with it. It's of no value to anybody. Hey, I really appreciate you listening to me. If I sound a little emotional, I've been involved in this process way too long. It's kind of gotten to me at times. But I strongly feel that all of us as Oregonians really ought to have the same concept and appreciation for the land as we and farmers do. So if you have any questions, I'll do my best to answer them. And if you can call me at any time, and I'll do my best to answer them.
Thank you, Sam. Marge.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marge Easley, and I'm here representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League is a nonpartisan, grassroots, all-volunteer political organization that encourages informed citizen participation in government. We have been interested in this issue for quite some time. We believe that Oregon's most fertile farmland is a precious and finite resource that should be carefully preserved, and we've provided consistent testimony throughout many of the past, probably the last decade. Our support is based on our strong land use positions, but also on the fact that we, two members of the League, myself and Liz Frankel, represented the public interest on the aggregate farmland consensus group from 2004 to 2006. We are not farmers, we are not miners, we are representing the public. And so we have a unique perspective that we feel is an important one to think about. We sat in on these meetings, we listened carefully, we took many notes, we learned a lot about the quantity of rock in Oregon, the location of rock in Oregon, the alternatives, and the amount of farmland that is being destroyed. We do believe that both the aggregate and farming industries supply a critical public need. But we know that there is no chance that Oregon is going to run out of rock in the near future. In the foreseeable future, and we have a great deal of concern when confronted by the alarming rate that our best farm soils are being lost in the Willamette Valley. We support any bill that will alleviate this problem. There have been many bills before this. We feel that these two bills before you today are reasonable compromises. And we realize that it's going to be a compromise. No side is really going to win in this. But we feel that there are alternatives. We feel that the alluvial gravel is not inherently better than quarry rock. It is just easier to mine and less expensive to transport. Transportation seems to be the key factor, the cost of transporting the rock. And as Mr. Chapin mentioned, there are alternatives, an alternative means of transportation that need to be looked at. So the League strongly urges a due pass on HB 2201 and HB 2202. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Vice Chair Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chapin, you mentioned in your opening statement that there was 200 to 400 acres a year in Marion County being lost to aggregate.
No, that's in the Willamette Valley, total. The 200 to 400. And that was based on tonnage figures that we had given to us on the consensus group that came from DeGamy. That's how we estimated that back.
So 200 to 400 acres, surface acres of land a year in
the Willamette Valley.
Okay. Because the testimony before you was there was only 400 acres in Marion County lost over the last 9 years. And I was just trying to clarify that.
I'm not sure how that figure would come up. Windsor Island itself had about a 300-acre site permitted in Mission Bottom. Gosh, I'm having trouble with the date, about 4 years ago. That's now, and that site hasn't, that's one of the invisible sites, because you can't see it because they haven't started mining
yet. Yeah, follow up if I may. As a hamburger flipper, I'm trying to learn about mining and farming here.
Sure.
So when you say permitted, it's a permitted use in the future. Is it still being farmed today?
At this moment, it's being farmed.
Okay.
But it's committed to, it will in time be destroyed for mining.
I have a series of questions.
Sure.
And maybe some of the. So we heard earlier testimony that there's approximately, since 1977, there was 920,000 acres of farmable land, and in 2003, still 920,000 acres. Do you agree with that or disagree with that statement?
I don't have figures to comment on that.
Okay.
I don't know how those figures were determined. The fact is, the total land out there is constant, and we are using it for multiple uses, and it's got to be shrinking. Now, so when they get to talking about harvested acres, I'm not sure what they're doing.
Follow up if I may.
Yep, follow up.
So we heard testimony from a previous witness, Ms. Bledsoe, about the Grand Island, and that a farmer sold the property to I guess a mining company. And I'm looking at the slide here on Windsor Island, and if I remember right, the blue is a current, is the blue current mining?
No, the blue, the red is the mining.
The red is the mining.
The blue shows Willamette Mission Park, 1,800 acres there.
Okay, that's what that is.
Yes.
Okay. So do you know, when I look at these red dots around here, do we know who owned those or who sold those and to whom and approximately when those were sold? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I can help you out with that. Okay, the red dot on the right, Viesco Sand and Gravel, started by Fred Viesco, probably in the 40s. Okay. Windsor Island, that is the top, which looks like a hourglass laying sideways. The south end of that island, sorry I can't give you the name, was owned by a private party. They got too close into the old channel of the Willamette. Division of State Lands now owns that when the courts got done with them. The north end of the island is privately owned. And in 2002, or in that time period, around 2000, it was owned by Spadas, and they sold it to Windsor Island Rock, and in 2002 is permitted for mining.
What, do we know what Spadas did before they sold the property?
They were harvesting potatoes on it the year before. Very productive soil there, very good soil. The area, the big hook on the bottom, on the left-hand side there, that 3 or 4 years ago, that property is owned by Doug Zielinski, and Windsor Island Rock has royalty rights to mine it.
Mr. Zielinski, what's he do for a living?
He is a farmer and nurseryman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. You got one more dot there. You want the history of that one on the bottom?
This one.
Bottom dot down?
Oh, yeah, the permitted future one. Right. Oh, that's what I wrote in there. I thought I already had it. Thank you.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
Okay. The dark red in the center, that is being mined by Knife River. The left-hand side of it was, Stats started mining it a small mine there about in the 70s. Prior to that, it was owned by the Reeds and farmed by them. As they retired, they sold out. Morris Brothers operated that operation. And then 92 through 96, in 96 they got permits to mine another 164 acres of that. And they got the entire area dedicated as a Goal 5 aggregate resource.
So, follow up if I may. Sure. So the previous landowners before Knife River, what was their occupation?
Oh, in that area, that's the Weathers family. And that's all being mined on a royalty basis.
The Weathers?
And they're hop farmers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for your great knowledge and history.
I'm pretty familiar with over the last 60 years in that area.
Any further questions for this panel? Representative Unger.
Thank you, Chair. We talked a little bit about how agri-mining hurts farmland itself, but can you talk a little bit about when we introduce mines into a particular area, how that impacts the farmers in the surrounding area? Because I'm assuming that part of the impact of these mines isn't just on the soil themselves, but on the farmers surrounding them. And if any of you have any experience, I'd appreciate to hear some of your testimony on that subject.
I personally feel that the main conflict is the fact that the land is disappearing in front of us. It does adversely affect us in that they do affect the price of land. You can't buy a farmer cannot afford to pay as much as a gravel company can. So you put this other use out there, and we have to compete against it, and we'll lose. Okay? So the average farmer is dependent upon rental land. 50% of the land that the average farmer operates is he's renting it. Both in the state of Oregon, that's a national average also. As you keep pulling this land out of here, and as land is moving from multiple generation, from one generation to the next, and the businesses are moving, you just get shrunk down, and it's a major problem for our ag business over time.
I would like to add to that. In Grand Island's case, there's just one road, and it's a very narrow road, one narrow bridge. So, and when they did the traffic study, each mine was going to generate 60 to 70 truckloads a day. So you got 140 trucks coming out of a single road system. I mean, that's a big impact to ag traffic during harvesting and planting season. And that was one of the big issues there, plus the groundwater. Because when they excavate out these pits, they have to suck the water out, which draws down the whole water table for the surrounding area. Down on Grand Island, a lot of the water that comes for irrigation is wells. It's only about 30 feet deep. Well, if they dig down 50 or 60 feet deep, they're going to suck out all the water in the surrounding areas. So those are the two big areas of concern for Grand Island.
Thank you. Thanks, Chair.
You bet. Okay, thank you. And let's get Steve Wilder, if he's still here, please. We know you've got to get going. And then how about Steve Fry and Dave, either Ball or Bull? And Mr. Wilder, we'll do you and then questions for you, and then I know you need to leave, and then we'll do the other two gentlemen. Please, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, representatives. Thank you for taking the time to hear from me today. I'm Steve Wildish, Vice President of Wildish Santa Gravel Company, located in Lane County, adjacent to the city of Eugene. I'm here in opposition of House Bill 2201 and 2202. With respect to House Bill 2201, This bill is in direct conflict with our Goal 5 land use policy. To site a mine, you have to dig at least 60 feet deep, or show that you can dig at least 60 feet deep. We dig an average of about 80 feet deep. To reclaim the land back to its original farm purposes is impossible. As we dig deep to conserve farmland, to do something different than that would require that we, in essence, strip mine and dig shallow and consume more farmland. So the industry has always been advocates for digging deep, taking advantage of as much of the resource as possible, and limiting the impact of adjacent land. With respect to House Bill 2202, this bill would be devastating to us. 20 years ago, we purchased farmland adjacent to our current operation. Farmer came to us. He believed the land was unproductive, even though it was Class 2. Class 2 involves actually quite a wide range of quality of farmland. That land, for two decades, has been looked upon to be our future. We have invested an incredible amount of capital building infrastructure for that future expansion. And I'm going to pass out a few pictures showing some of that. We recently just built a state-of-the-art concrete plant. We're very proud of it. There's a picture of it. We think it's one of the best plants in the Northwest. We also built a bridge over the McKenzie River to convey sand and gravel into our processing plant. It's low impact environmentally. We don't use trucks. And our future expansion area would be served by this conveyor system. There's a couple pictures of that bridge. We also, over the years, have spent and invested a lot into our sand and gravel processing facility, as well as we built a two-mile berm to protect us from floodwaters and fish capture at the confluence of the McKenzie-Willamette Rivers. These are all things that, for a family business, not easy to do, but something that we invested in our future. House Bill 2202 requires an alternative analysis be done on Class 2 soils. Well, in essence, this analysis would pull the rug out from under our family and our future. It takes an objective process and makes it subjective. As Steve Pfeiffer mentioned, the most expensive case that he knew of a siting case was the Eugene Sand and Gravel case in Eugene. Well, we're very aware of that case. They're neighbors of ours. We watched it, followed it throughout the whole process. And we know that we're not immune of a similar process when it comes time for us. It won't be easy. It'll be expensive. But we're prepared to do that under the current rule. We believe House Bill 2202 would basically make it impossible for us to pursue expansion under an alternative analysis. I've heard mention here that we need to head for the hills, go to the quarries. Well, I'm a third generation sand and gravel operator. The point is sand and gravel. That's what we do. That's where we are. That's where our land is. That's where our investment is. That's where our future is. We're not heading to the hills. We'd be out of business. Quarries have a lot of environmental impacts in and of themselves. The increased trucking, the quality of aggregates is nowhere near what we have in sand and gravel. You have to manufacture your sand. You don't have round rock for your concrete. It's not comparable. We're blessed in this state, in the Willamette Valley, to have some of the best sand and gravel resources anywhere. And say that we need to just move to the quarries is not the right answer. Thank you.
So let's do questions for Steve because he needs to get to a meeting in Portland. If any, Representative Holby.
Well, thanks for coming up and chatting with me about this issue. There's been a lot of talk about the quarry rock, the basalt rock versus the round rock and the sand and gravel, and I think you sort of alluded to the differences in those rocks and what they're actually used for. Can you, expand on that so we understand the importance of the round rock versus the quarry rock?
Right. The best concrete has round rock that's found only in sand and gravel deposits and natural sand. In quarries, you have no round rock. It's all sharp material. And you have to manufacture your sand, which is much more expensive. Plus, we're located right on the edges of Eugene. And we would have to truck from a quarry at quite some distance. There's a reason why sand and gravel operations are located closer to the cities, because the transportation costs are really equal to, in many cases, to the processing material itself.
Follow up. Sure. And just, because I'm just familiar with a couple of rock quarries that are up in the hills and the footprint that has on the landscape and the neighbors up there. You have a footprint down in the bottom of the valley with neighbors there. I mean, I'm just kind of trying to weigh what the difference of the arguments up there would be versus the arguments down there as far as your footprint and the carbon, the neighborhood and all, the environmental impacts.
Well, we've been in business, sand and gravel, for 60 years. And we've been in the construction business for 77 years. We believe we're good neighbors. I think our history shows that in our community. We mine with conveyors that are low impact, and we're committed to every environmental law there is that applies to us. And quarries, it's easy to say go mine in the quarry, but some of the most serious environmental issues historically have happened on quarries, primarily from runoff water. So to say that they're better or even equal in that regard, I don't believe is the case.
Okay. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you for your testimony. And do you have any idea how much of the gravel in the area you're talking about, either from your quarry, your area, or Eugene Sand and Gravel, or the general area, goes to public works projects? And if, say, you move to the hills, how much additional expense that would create?
Well, we're primarily a public works contractor. I would say 85% of all our material goes to public works for asphalt, highways, for airport runways, for city and county streets. Depending on where you would have to move to, in our case, it's really you don't even get going on it, given the level of investment that we've made at our particular site. But if you would set up something portable, for example, at a quarry outside our area, with the transportation and increased processing costs, you could easily double and triple the cost. And then when you look at building concrete plants and all the major infrastructure for the long haul, it would be higher than that.
I guess, Mr. Chair, maybe a little follow-up. So then how much per unit of rock, per ton, additional, how much is it for shipping? I mean, if you had to go a mile, how much is it for shipping a mile? So then you can extrapolate out the distances. Then you would be able to figure out.
Where's the calculator?
Sorry. If it's too hard. Well, it's just a rough route.
Unfortunately, I'm in the administration owner.
Yeah, I understand. I know.
Steve actually is going to talk about that, and I could take a stab at that, Representative, but I probably wouldn't be as close as he would be.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wilder, you have a really nice bridge. I wonder how much you would charge us. Never mind.
How many lanes? Is there light rail?
That's a beautiful looking bridge. Thank you.
Well, we're proud of that. We don't know of anything else again in the Northwest that compares to that. So
it's coming.
Oh, goodness. Okay, I think you can go to your
thank
meeting
you
safely.
Much.
We've devolved
appreciate
into other topics now.
I get the concrete for that.
So Dave or Steve, whoever's.
I'll go next.
Okay.
My name is Dave Bull. I apologize for my voice. I'm the president of Knife River Materials. Our Knife River companies in Oregon employ about 950 people, and we're involved in the mining and production of aggregates, and then in the production of ready mix, the production of asphalt, and we have paving crews that do paving around the state. We also have a pre-stressed concrete division in Harrisburg that makes the long bridge girders that you might see traveling down the highway. There are two points that I wanted to talk about today in opposition to these two bills. And the first, I'm going to attempt to answer the question, is there a difference in the quality of rock that lies under the Class 1 and 2 soils versus what's available in the quarries? We operate both. We have a number of quarries and we have a number of sand and gravel holdings, and I can tell you that there is a large difference in quality between the two. I respect the fact that the Class 1 and 2 soils give to the agricultural community a premier place to grow their crops, that they can grow things there that can't grow elsewhere and with less effort. I understand that, and I'm all for preserving that. But what I would like you to understand is that just beneath the surface of that soil lies the premier aggregate in the state of Oregon, and that is the sand and gravel that lies beneath there. And there are things that you can do with that aggregate that you cannot do with the quarry rock. We have a pre-stress plant that I alluded to earlier, and we are able to make beams that are 180 feet long. We're able to build bridges that span streams that otherwise would have needed to have columns placed right into the stream bed. And we can do that because we have the aggregate available from these under these Class 1 and 2 soils. We're able to hit 7,000 PSI in just 12 hours instead of hitting 3,000 PSI in 28 days like most concrete does. We haul sand and gravel from our source in Corvallis right past our quarries to get to our pre-stress operation because we cannot achieve the same strengths with our quarry material that we can with that sand and gravel. In the same manner, we are currently providing about 40,000 cubic yards of ready mix to the new Willamette River Bridge in Eugene. This is called high-performance concrete. It allows the structure to be smaller in size because it is stronger. We are purchasing aggregate from another supplier there instead of using our own quarry material that's available to us. We are purchasing this sand and gravel that has these extraordinary qualities. We have five asphalt plants in the Willamette Valley. Some of them even sited at quarries, and yet we are using sand and gravel to make the asphalt in every case because it is so difficult these days to meet federal aviation specifications for paving on runways and all the other ODOT specs that we're required to meet. We can only meet it with the high quality premier aggregate that lays underneath the Class 1 and 2 soils. The aggregate is durable, it resists freeze and thaw, It is low water absorption, so that when you put it into ready mix, it's not susceptible to the freeze and thaw or to excessive shrinkage, which shows up in a lot of specifications these days for water treatment plants and sewage treatment plants. It is clean. It is consistent. You can count on it remaining the same. It is just, it is analogous, I think, to the soil that lies above it. They are both premier. The class 1 or 2 soils are excellent for agriculture, and the sand and gravel that lays underneath it is our best aggregate. So I have good news for you. We don't need much of it. And this gets to the handout that you have. There's been a lot of discussion today about how much property is actually being used up of this prime farmland. A lot of it is sort of anecdotal. This comes from a study that emanated from, I think, 2005, the legislature here, a study undertaken by the Oregon State University to actually determine what percentage of the Class 1 and 2 soils are actually ending up being disturbed by mining. And as of 2005, their number was the number that was given to you earlier, 0.11% of the available Class 1 and Class 2 soils. In another study, the Yeager study that was done as an outgrowth of the same work group, they attempted to predict going forward over the next 45 years from 2005 to 2050 how much additional Class 1 and Class 2 soils would be necessary if we don't restrict the use of the sand and gravel. And the study came up with somewhere between another 0.5% and 0.7%. That was the range that they gave of what would be used over that 45-year period. We are not the main reason why prime farmland is disappearing. And I would argue that there is a need for prime farmland, this premium farmland, but there is the state also needs the aggregate that lies underneath it, a small part of it. The Goal 5 process, I think you've heard from different members here, is difficult, it's arduous, and it's not a rubber stamp. We win and we lose, and that's as it should be, I think, when a process is working. Nobody can guarantee victory, and each case is decided on its merits. And so I would ask you not to mess with that, not to change that existing Goal 5 process. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please.
Well, my name is Steve Fry. I'm a regional vice president with Knife River also. We have about 900 and some plus employees in this area in Oregon. And I'm going to talk about two topics. The impacts of transportation on the cost of aggregates, if there's a question of that. I'm also going to talk about what has happened with reclamation on the lands that exist that have come up through these studies. I'm going to refer to the two studies that Dave cited, one done by reference by the legislature, and then another one by Oregon State in the Yeager report. I'm going to start with transportation issues. And to determine what the impacts were, I wanted to give everybody some information about that. And you got a couple of handouts that I made for you. It talks about the amount of rock that's used in each of the counties. And this is from Doug Ammey. So Doug Ammey's numbers is where this comes from. He talked about what is the impact in the counties in the Willamette Valley. And you can see that in the Willamette Valley, in those counties, in 2006, there was about 24 million tons of use of rock. That's a lot of tons. Currently, with the economic conditions, in 2011, there's only about 10 million tons being taken and used in the marketplace. So if we look at those, the Willamette Valley is mainly sand and gravel sources. There are quarry sites within there, but the vast majority in those areas would be in the lowlands. Thus, they are alluvial plain deposits. So if we took that 10 million tons and we looked at what the cost was, and every situation is different, but what I tried to give to each of you to look at is what the impacts would be at just a 10-mile difference. Now, that's 5 miles each way. what a 20-mile difference in haul would be and what a 30-mile difference in haul. I think those are all realistic differences in haul to the foothills. And in some cases, it may be longer than that, particularly if you're talking about going up river into eastern Oregon along the Columbia River. You have first $4 or $5 to get it down to Portland, and then depending on what part of the valley, you might be 80 miles of hauling to bring those gravels. So if we look at those impacts, it will be someplace from a dollar standpoint at the low estimate of 15 cents a ton mile to 30 or to 20 cents a ton mile. Those numbers came out of the Yeager study that was done at Oregon State University. Those are not my numbers. Those are the numbers that were done as a study. With the DOGGAMI and Department of Agriculture, or the Farm Bureau were involved in some of these studies, so the statistics should be accurate. We're looking at $15 million to $61 million in economic impact for transportation, depending on whether you're 10 miles away on a low cost of 15 cents to 30 miles away at the high additional cost of 20 cents a ton mile. Those are large economic impacts. Those are annual impacts. It's not one-time impacts. That's the impact every year. That's a large amount. Now, that's at the $10 million, this economic activity. Our economic activity just a few years back was double that or more than double, which would translate to $30 to $120 million annually. That also impacts jobs. And for our industry, it takes revenues of about $430,000 to sustain a job in our industry. That's at the low end, 36 jobs to 143 under current economic conditions. Those numbers double as economic activity goes up. Those are real jobs. Those are people in our communities up and down the Willamette Valley. Those are well-paid jobs, their family wage jobs, and I don't know what the multiplier effect is. I think you guys have good ideas. I've heard everything from 3 to 7 times that. We're a primary industry. We're not a service industry, so it builds multiple times. So it's very important to us. These jobs are important. The second thing I wanted to talk about reclamation?
Quickly as you can.
Quickly.
We're going to go to Thursday anyway. It's clear, by the way.
Okay. Everybody talked about what happens to the land afterwards. And in those studies, it was also shown that 22% of the land goes back into farming. And we have a good example in Corvallis where we work with a farmer, the Chambers, Bill and Carla, and we have worked together to create farmland for them as we have mined through portions of the property. We've reclaimed, and they have organic farming on those properties and are quite productive. So, yes, we do have an impact. We can't reclaim it all, but it's into farmland. But all of the land is reclaimed into a use. And the chart that I gave you shows the uses. And a lot of these uses are very important to us as a society. So when we talk about the land and its use, we need to look at all of the uses that it would have. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you, gentlemen. And I'm going to just try and move on and get through at least a few more panels today. So, other side, Lori Freeman Swanson, Peter Kanegi, and Neil Svarvarud. As close as I'm going to get, I think. And on the other side, next, I have Mark Bauer, George Adams, and Bob Short. If for some reason between Rich and Casey someone can't come back for sure, straight into that next panel, if you could. And Ivan and Steve McCoy, I know you can come back, or at least I'm summoning you back Thursday, but I don't know about Aileen, so we'll try and get Aileen in before we finish. Okay, please, Lori, I've got you first, and then Peter, okay. Then Neil.
Good afternoon. You have to let me know if I can. There, I guess you can hear me now. My name is Lori Freeman Swanson, and I'm here to represent the Moales Citizens Planning Organization in Clackamas County, and actually myself, who has gone through one of these applications, actually three, over a period of almost 9 years. I own a 250-acre farm in Moala that's been in my family for 91 years. I raise several crops as well as run a herd of beef cattle. According to a agricultural land analysis done in Clackamas County, there are 186,258 acres of producing farmland, which converts to about 15.48% of the land in Clackamas County. These bills, I forgot to say at the beginning, I'm supporting these bills. These bills address the sensitivity of maintaining our farmland. Right now, mining companies are able to leave a 100-acre productive farm field as a gutted 25 to 60-foot deep hole filled with water, often contaminated. The farm areas around the mine will be lucky if the wells and the irrigation districts also are not contaminated. Mining brings the possibility of dewatering wells and contaminating water that travels within the same aquifer. So far, we have been fortunate in the Willamette Valley with the consequences of climate change. While many in the Midwest and Southern states have been suffering major droughts, we have been able to continue to grow crops and increase production. We have been able to raise our cattle, sheep, and hogs without fear of low water levels or lack of food. Moving our crops to eastern Oregon obviously would be prohibitive on so many levels. Water being number one, temperature, winter non-growing weather, inability to offer fresh produce to major cities over the mountains to the west, and many more ideas. Local farming direct delivery has grown immensely over the past 8 to 10 years. Portland alone does $3 million and then some in local delivery to restaurants. Products also go into Washington local areas, Vancouver, Clark County, as well as our own Salem, Oregon City, Canby, Silverton, Newburgh, McMinnville, and on. Farmers markets do $50 to $100 million in business. A few years back, a former Clackamas County Commissioner, with her expertise being in transportation, noted that there were enough permitted mines in Clackamas County to take us up through 2035. Our valley is fertile, and the only area in the state where gravel mining is allowed on prime farmland. Mining takes farmland out of production forever, and we cannot afford to continue in this model. In listening to the previous testimonies, I just have a couple of other things that came quickly to mind. This day is a little bit of a, in my mind, a little bit, I've been through lots of presentations, and so it's hard to know how much people know and don't know, but for me, having gone through this process, I will say two things, two big items, water, number one, and money, number two, or also number one. In Oregon, there are, and I haven't checked lately, as in the last year, But they're probably over 90, a little bit over 90% of the gravel companies are owned by four international mining companies. And, of course, farms are family-owned on a small basis. The system to appeal or fight these appeal these applications is long and very expensive. The numbers that the fellows quoted you on the gravel side match with the farm side's expenditures. And we're talking about different folks paying here. So I would just appreciate you keeping that in mind. And the other thing I will say is, and then I'll be finished, is that in my years of working with this and going through, at a certain point I was trying to get a feel for reclamation and the percentage of reclamation and how that went. And my experience is that the reclamation process percentage is very low. It is not monitored. In theory, Dugami monitors it. Dugami is, you know, its dues are paid by the gravel companies. So there you go.
To wrap up.
Yep. And I thank you for listening to me. This is very important.
Thanks, Peter.
Chair Clam, members of the Land Use Committee, my name is Peter Kanagi. I'm a farmer in Benton County. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you in favor of House Bill 2202. House Bill 2202 is a bill that is long overdue. This past week's Capital Press carried an article about the loss of 3 million acres of farmland in 2012. And we are constantly bombarded with the information in the media that with the growth in population and the standard of living, we will need to double food production in the next 50 years. And yet we as a state continue to allow the destruction of some of our best farmland for the consumptive use of gravel extraction when viable alternatives exist that would allow us to continue to use our best farmland sustainably and indefinitely into the future for its highest and best use. Aggregate is an important resource that we all use and depend on, but we also need to eat. There are other viable options for extracting aggregate to meet our needs, even if they cost a little more. But we do not have any other viable options for finding additional farmland to produce our food on. House Bill 2202 is an extremely reasonable and timely bill that will help ensure that our kids and grandkids have the agricultural land base that they will need in the future. And unlike what some of the aggregate interests have mentioned, that this is actually a ban on mining in Class 1 and 2 soils, it really is not. There are places within the valley that, first off, there's a lot of farmland that has rock very near the surface. You think about out near the Staten area along the CNEM, there's lots of rocky ground that would be appropriate places to mine. There are places in Benton County where I spent 13 years on the Planning Commission, and one of the permits that we approved down there, which to me made a lot of sense, was an area where a farmer had a gravel bar in his field. You know, it was a ridge of gravel running through his field, and there was a permit to go in, take that gravel out, and reclaim it. That's the kind of aggregate mining that makes sense in the river bottoms. These deep pits don't. And the other point, Steve Wildish's point about rock, or the rock being, you know, the best for concrete and stuff, begs the question, and one of you should ask the aggregate, what percentage of alluvial rock is actually used for that purpose? And how much of it used for other purposes where quarry rock would suffice? I think that's an important point to tease out when you have another aggregate person up here with the expertise to ask that. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Neil?
Yes, thank you very much. I'd like to start by saying, they keep talking about the class.
Your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry, Neil Swarrood. I live on Grand Island Road. they keep talking about the amount of Class 1 and 2 farmland and what a small percentage this is. But that's not what the real case is. What we're talking about is Willamette River bottomland, the narrow area in the floodplain along the Willamette River. Now, when you look at that, and then and that's where they want to take the gravel. From Egypt's time on, the bottom land along rivers is the richest land in the world. That's where the food comes from. They want to take a much higher percentage of the Willamette River bottom land than they're letting on by talking about all Class 1 and 2 farmland. I think it's really important to understand what percentage of this sand and gravel is going into very high-tech, very neat, cool concrete projects, such as pre-stressed bridge things, and how what percentage is going into fill. Fill for highways, fill for the Ross in West Salem, if anybody watched when they put the parking lot in there. Fill, I believe it was the Walmart in Albany. Look how much of the sand and gravel went into that. Those kind of things. So get that straight so you know what we're talking about. I'm actually here to talk about traffic. It affects me personally. And I would like to just read this very quickly and then I'll be done. This is a Goal 5 process. Goal 5 is interesting as it so clearly pits the multinational corporations with their enormous legal, lobbying, and political contribution powers against Oregon family farmers. On one side, we have zoning laws. Well, I'll interrupt here. They keep talking about like who owns it, who sold it. It's nothing to do with that. When you buy and sell your home, the zoning doesn't change. It's a zoning issue. It's not an ownership issue. It's not anything else but a zoning issue. It's zoned farmland. They change it. They make money. Anyway, it's been the basis of pricing rural real estate for 40 years. On the other, we have corporations that make huge windfall profits by changing farmland zoning to aggregate zoning. They don't even have to mine the site. Simply sell it to another corporation who makes their profit by making the hole in the ground. My personal experience is with the Baker Rock site at Grand Island, and as such, I would like to tell Grand Island's traffic story. Just as Goal 5 starts out to protect natural resources and conserve scenic and historic areas and open spaces, so too does Baker Rock's traffic impact study by Lancaster Engineering. They state in the trip generation summary that the total daily trips are entering trips 37, exiting trips 37, total trips 74. And just as the Goal 5 really means that family farmers have no real protection under Goal 5, so too does Yamhill County's finding truck traffic no significant impact on farming really means that when the economy is booming, 200 loads a day in the construction season from the Baker Rock site, plus likely 200 more loads a day from the Burnett Towing Grand Island site. 400 trips a day in the farming season. This is from an email that Bill Gilley, the Yamhill County engineer, sent the Yamhill County Planning Department after a site visit with John Phelan, I believe his name is, the director of the Yamhill County Roads. And this gets to the bottom of everything. There's all this talk here by the expensive lawyers that everybody hires, but when you get out on the ground, you're faced with a completely different reality. Is it 37 trucks coming in and going off a day, or is it 200? And this entire Goal 5 process and the entire Class 1 and 2 soils is riddled with this dichotomy that you have all these fancy words and then you have what's happening out on the ground. And that's what I think you need to get to the bottom of when you make your decision. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I make one quick point?
I know.
I didn't use my 3 minutes.
I know, but I've got 6 minutes and I want to at least. You can come back on Thursday too and go again if you like. Thank you, though. So I need to get Mark, whoever the next three are. I've got Mark, George, and Bob, but if that's not workable for one of either Rich or Casey's schedules, then swap in.
Okay.
And we'll go a little bit past five. Some members have something at five they may have to leave for, but we're going to stay through at least this panel, and we'll be even for the day, and then we can start Thursday with the next groups. We can all just stay here, me, and they'll all leave. It'll be great. Please. Mark, I've got first, but it doesn't, okay. Whatever you prefer.
Chair Clam and representatives, thank you for allowing me the time to speak today. My name is Mark Bauer. I work for Baker Rock Resources in Beaverton. And I'm here today to discuss impacts to jobs from House Bill 2201 and 2202. Unlike previous testimony, Baker Rock is not a large multinational corporation. We're a local, family-owned and operated company that's been in business for 50 years in the state of Oregon. Over these last 50 years, our third-generation company has grown from 4 employees to 100 employees. And our employees reside in communities all the way from Salem to Vancouver, from Malala to the Pacific Coast. And many of our employees have been with our company for over 20 years. And a lot of the success for our company is to our employees. Not only do we provide family wage jobs, we've benefited our local communities and the state of Oregon for many years with competitive aggregate products and quality aggregate products, which are essential components for quality concrete and asphalt and the building blocks for all our roads and bridges and structures that we all depend on every day. The effects of House Bill 2201 and 2202 will have a detrimental impact on our ability to provide family wage jobs. Not only are portions of these bills for us unachievable and not capable of even of performing the reclamation, but also the way we see it is that it will essentially prohibit mining in Class 1 and 2 soils. And again, I'll be brief. I'll just summarize by saying that Baker Rock wouldn't be the company today without the ability to permit new resources. If we weren't mining the resource, or if we wouldn't have permitted the resources that we're mining today, we wouldn't be a third-generation company. And without the ability to permit future resources, we most likely won't see any new generations. And that's all I had, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. George?
Yes, George Adams. Thank you for allowing us to talk to you. Appreciate it. We're a small business, 80 families we support. Family-owned and has been. I've been with the company 43 years, and the company's been in existence for about 60 years. Primarily, we do in-water dredging and also ready-mix concrete, sand, and gravel. The reason that I'm here today is that we did invest. In fact, our largest asset is in property on Grand Island. And basically, the reason we did that, Corps of Engineers, we had dredging permits over the years, and National Marine Fisheries decided the salmon when endangered, they eliminated our dredging permits. So to stay in business, we went out and purchased resources for the future, which is now. that investment and the property for us, our size company, is approximately 50 years. We bought 440 acres. 220 is the mine site. And presently, it's all in organic farm and being farmed. And will continue to be farmed even when we're working there, which we haven't started yet. Restoration, we have a, we're in the nursery business, so we have, we're restoring property right now at Soey's Island, an old mine, a old lumber mill, Alder Creek Lumber. We're restoring that property under contract. And so our plan is when we are through or during that, actually when we're, when we do get to Grand Island, we'll restore property as we mine. And we've done that in the past, and topsoil is being used in other locations to improve property that is not, does not have good soil. So we have a plan to do the same or similar thing at Grand Island. Basically, I would like to say that small business like ourselves have been consumed, and we'd like not that to have happened, but that would be probably the alternative if this continues. And that's what I would like you to hear.
Thank you. Thanks for staying.
Hi, I'm Bob Short. I am actually a private citizen. I live in Portland. I was employed for 31 years by Cal Portland Company, also known as Glacier Northwest, which is a large multinational corporation.
Now you're just a retiree.
Yeah, now I'm just a retiree. Cal Portland employs 300 Oregonians in the Portland metropolitan area. We pay full benefit, high-wage jobs, and we are primarily a concrete company. I was came here prepared to talk about mixed designs and the value of alluvial aggregates to the concrete industry, but Mr. Bull did such a good job of covering that that I'm going to walk through a kind of a case study of what happened under Goal 5 at the Meyer site in Columbia County, which, according to the Oregon administrative rules, is considered part of the Willamette Valley and therefore would be affected by this bill. Just an aside about mining. You know, we're in the business of mining because we're a concrete company and we are primarily interested in sand and gravel to make concrete. Not everything that comes out of that pit is suitable for that purpose. So you, instead of putting it up in a surge pile or something and letting it go, you sell it for other purposes. So it's just, it's the nature of the business that if you are in the business of extracting concrete, sand, and gravel, not everything you get out of the ground is going to be suitable for that purpose. So, but it has other, it has a market value, a lower market value for other things. And but what I want to talk about just quickly is kind of the history of our permitting adventures in Columbia County. About 30 years ago, we acquired a 400-acre tract of land called the Meyer property, which is, has been somewhat famous in Oregon because it sparked a 20-year controversy over whether that property should be mined or not. Ultimately, the matter was resolved by mediation that was put on by the governor's office. And as that property, by the way, is largely composed of Class 2 and Class 3 soils. Prior to our acquisition, it had been a dairy farm in Columbia County. Part of it is among the rocky soils that the gentleman earlier was alluding to. In fact, the farmer spoke about part of it by saying, "If you think that's prime farmland, put a plow in it." The result of the mediated compromise was that that land would not be mined. Ironically, in its wisdom, local government in Columbia County chose to reserve that land for industrial purposes, and it's now going through the process of being included in the Scappoose urban growth boundary. So it is eventually going to be used for something other than farming and something other than mining. As a result of that, we, as part of the compromise, we were able to acquire from willing sellers another several hundred acres, part of which we're mining now. It was in agricultural production for the last 30 years. They were growing cottonwood trees on it. It's about 300 acres. It's about a 20-year aggregate supply. Oh, by the way, the Meyer property that we didn't mine contains 80 million tons of high quality. It's probably the best unmined gravel site in the state. And 80 million tons is a lot. Our operation in Columbia County is unique because rather than putting trucks on the road, 90% of the material goes out of there by barge on the Willamette River system. We're currently mining what's known as the Bates Roth property, which is about a 300-acre site, has about 20 years worth of reserves on it. That site has mostly Class 3, perhaps 20 acres of Class 2 on it. We have a future, another 400 acres that are our long-term gravel reserves that is more than 5, less than 10 acres of Class 2 soil. It's currently being used for grazing. And part of it is grown cottonwoods. The point I want to make about this is after 30 years and well over $1 million in cost, not to mine the finest gravel site in the state of Oregon, the company's future mining resources would be disallowed by this bill, because they contain more than 5 acres of Class 2 soils, even though it's only slightly more. So I think that for that reason alone, if no other, that we would have to strongly oppose this effort. Any questions?
Questions for this panel? Vice Chair Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Short, for somebody, I think you said you're retired, you still have a wealth of knowledge of the industry and what's going on.
Well, I've been retired less than a year, Representative.
Oh, okay. Okay, I'll have to remember that. I just have a question about the job impact, the employment impact on what you just said about your business and the future of your business. Maybe either one of you could talk about the job aspect. If these bills were to pass, is there an impact on the jobs in the state of Oregon? In your industry?
Well, I think that the impact on it's hard really to say because if I can't say how we would manage to continue to make high quality concrete, whether we would look for resources, try to make it out of lower quality material or to import it from somewhere else. The fact of the matter is, other than the alluvial gravels, there are not sources of concrete sand and of high quality aggregate in the state of Oregon. You know, they're granitic. There isn't much granite in Oregon that is in this form. So, you know, that's going to increase the cost of making concrete. I'm sure that's going to, what impact that's going to have on the economy in Oregon, on cost overruns on CRC, for example. I really can't give you an answer for that.
Could I respond to that? Because our family operation would not exist. That's our livelihood is the deposit that we work out of. Otherwise, we go to our sometimes friendly competitors to buy material so we can operate our operation. And that's we're in business. We have to make some money to stay in business. It would accomplish us going out of business, I'm sure. It wouldn't take long either.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any more questions?
No questions, but I would be interested for Thursday if we could have. I know that Dogami actually did do a study about the number of farmland acres that were affected by aggregate mining. If we could get Vicki to come up, and I see her back there. Hi, Vicki. Sorry to put you on the
spot. Trying to hide, but
I know,
she can't.
It would be great just to hear from Dogami what the, because they did do a study, so we could get some seemingly known person information there. And then the other thing would be, it would be great if someone from the industry could tell us about the percentage of high quality concrete that we're making from these aggregate mines. That was a good question that somebody brought up that we didn't get a chance to get to.
So. It's a rich task. Did you get that one for Thursday?
Someone asked, what's the percentage of the high quality? People keep on talking about the high quality stuff that we only can get from there. It'd be good. It's an interesting question to get from. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, you everybody, for your patience. Sorry to not cut people off, but you know we've got time in this committee, so it's worth exploring this a little deeper, given it's only a 30-year war. And with that, I will carry over House bills. I lost my quorum.
I
can carry over. I still lost my quorum.
No.
One, two, three, four, five. No. All right, never mind. Yeah, please, thank you. I'm going to carry over House Bills 2201 and 2202. That's it, right? And close the... That's it. Adjourn the committee.
Right, you got it.